This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We all remember the heartbreaking images of dolphins accidentally caught and killed by tuna fishermen, and the subsequent rise of dolphin-safe tuna. Well, unfortunately, that kind of bycatch, as it's called, isn't a thing of the past. Fishermen around the world each year accidentally catch more than 7 million tons of marine life that they weren't even after. In some cases, they can land and sell that extra catch, but in many cases, it's simply collateral damage. And of course, fishing has other environmental impacts. In some parts of the ocean, the scars left by trawls dragged across the seafloor can be seen for years. My guests today are working to reduce these negative side effects of fishing, trying to make our world's fisheries more sustainable and more environmentally friendly. They're doing that by redesigning the very gear used to catch fish. Joining me in our Woods Hole studio is Ron Smolowitz. He's president of Coonamesset Farm and treasurer of the Coonamesset Farm Foundation, a private research group working on sustainable fisheries, aquaculture, and agriculture. Joining us from WGBH in Boston is Tim Werner. He's a senior scientist in the John F. Prescott Marine Laboratory at the New England Aquarium. He also directs the Consortium for Wildlife Bycatch Reduction. And on the phone from Portland, Maine, Steve Ayers. He's a research scientist at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, where he leads efforts to design environmentally friendly fishing gear. Welcome, all of you, to Living Lab.
Thank you, Heather.
Thanks, Heather.
Now, I want to start with this phrase, environmentally friendly fishing gear. It sounds kind of like an oxymoron, so I would love to hear from each of you what that phrase means to you. And Steve, this is a phrase you use in your own research description, so we'll start with you. What do you think of as environmentally friendly fishing gear?
Well, I think it's fishing gear that's been developed over a period of time to reduce environmental impacts as best as possibly can be achieved at this present point. There's been a lot of work done in this part of the world over the last decade or so, developing fishing gear, making it more selective so that you retain more of what you want and less of what you don't want, and also reducing the impacts on the seabed. So over the years, fishermen and researchers in this area have done a pretty good job, in my mind, at reducing those impacts as great as they possibly can. Now, not all those impacts have been eliminated at this point in time. It's a really difficult thing to achieve. But you know, the point is that the gear has been improved over a long period of time and is, you know, relatively environmentally friendly.
Ron Smolowitz, environmentally friendly fishing gear. What would that phrase mean to you?
Well, it's sort of like saying an environmentally friendly tractor. I think what it means, not to use the term environmentally friendly, what you're trying to do is design a piece of gear that does not have adverse impacts. You minimize whatever impacts are not necessary for its primary function, which is harvesting a particular target fish at the right size without capturing any other non-target species.
And Tim Werner, this issue of bycatch is a major focus of your work. Is that really where you think the biggest work to make fishing gear more environmentally friendly needs to be focused?
I think it's a combination of reducing the swept area, so making the gear more efficient for the target species, reducing the amount of fossil fuels necessary to power the fishing vessel that's operating the gear, minimizing impact to non-target species such as benthic organisms that play an important ecological role, and you certainly don't want to go through and damage them. On the other hand, there's certain species that, as a farmer, I would call weeds, that you might want to be trimming back the same time that you're harvesting your target crop to maintain an ecosystem balance. So in that case, a bycatch mortality isn't necessarily a negative.
Tim Werner, you spend a lot of time thinking about and working on this issue of bycatch. And this statistic, which I got from the New England Aquarium, 7 million tons of bycatch each year. I mean, that just sounds really astounding. How does that even compare to the total intended catch of fisheries around the world?
Well, it really depends on the fishery. There's a fair bit of focus on what we call overfishing, where particular target stocks of fishes are fished to their maximum or over their maximum carrying capacity. But one thing we have to remember is that bycatch is often the greatest consequence of fishing. You have fisheries such as shrimp trawl fisheries that for every pound of shrimp you bring in 3 pounds of non-target species. And these can be species such as sea turtles. They can be marine mammals. They can be invertebrates. They can be sea cucumbers or rare corals. So it's important that to recognize that there is a huge portion of world fishing effort that ends up bringing in things that we really didn't intend to bring in, and it's not always a very efficient business.
I mean, U.S. fisheries are subject to quite a bit of federal and state level regulation. They're overseen and are considered widely to be some of the most sustainable fisheries in the whole world. How bad is the bycatch problem here in the U.S., or is this really just a problem of unregulated fisheries in other parts of the world?
Compared to many other countries, the U.S. is doing a pretty good job, but we have to be careful and conclude that there isn't a threat out there. For example, right here in our neck of the woods, people on Cape Cod are very familiar with the North Atlantic right whale, which comes to feed in April in Cape Cod Bay. Despite decades of regulations enacted on fishermen, particularly lobster fishermen in the Gulf of Maine, the incidence and severity of right whale entanglements has not gone down. In fact, recent data suggests the problem is even getting worse. So we certainly, compared to other countries, are doing a pretty good job, but we have a long way to go still.
Steve Ayers, we've hit on a few different forms of bycatch already, kind of in passing, whether it's fish or just species you didn't intend to catch, turtles, whales, dolphins. There's a huge range of forms that this can take, and I wonder if there is a cost to fishermen when they actually catch these unintended things.
In many respects, there can be a cost, and you know, some fisheries where they catch very large animals, turtles, sharks, etc., particularly some of the tropical shrimp fisheries, some of those animals can impact on the quality of the catch. So therefore, there's less income for the fishermen. Hauling large bags of catch around is a relatively inefficient process and can increase trawl drag. So there's a cost there in terms of fuel. So there is a cost to fishermen. But I think we also should recognise the improvements that have been made over the last decade or so. And the 7 million tonne figure that you speak of comes from the Food and Agriculture Organisation of the United Nations. Now, their previous report about a decade or so before cited a 27 million tonne figure for bycatch. Now, there has been improved reporting since, but a lot of that improvement is also due to fishing gear improvements and other changes, improved management, improved monitoring of bycatch and so on. So I think we should also recognise that there has been a vast improvement in fishing gear selectivity over the years, and the work continues to be done. In the New England groundfish fishery, for example, the fishermen here are towing generally a 6.5-inch diamond or square mesh cod end, and in my mind, that's one of the largest mesh sizes of any trawl fishery on the planet. Some fishermen are also using larger meshes because they realise it's in their interest not to catch bycatch. So while 7 million tonnes is still 7 million tonnes too much, I think we need to recognise the fact that there has been a lot of improvement, and we continue to make improvements all the time.
In case you're just joining us, my guests are Steve Ayers of the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, Ron Smolowitz of Coonamesset Farm, and Tim Wormner of the New England Aquarium. We invite you to join our conversation as well. Call us toll-free at 866-999-4626. Send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org or find us on Twitter and Facebook. Now, Ron, to Steve's point about the improvement in the gear, I mean, you've been designing fishing gear for more than 40 years. And I think it's easy to think, well, a hook's a hook, a net's a net. How much does this stuff really change? How quickly does fishing gear change?
It could change very fast. For example, the scallop fishery, we never really had a sea turtle problem. And in the year 2000, some of the dredges were reporting back that they were catching loggerhead sea turtles. The industry took it upon itself to realize that this could be a serious consequence in that we could get closed down from areas during certain seasons. So through a lot of industry effort with its academic partners and researchers, we designed some gear improvements to keep turtles out of the gear and not to harm them. And those changes were in effect in less than 5 years. And where we had estimates of 700 turtles per year being potentially caught in a scallop fishery in 2003, in the last 10 years, I don't think we've caught two turtles.
Give us some of the specifics. How do you actually change scallop gear to eliminate catching turtles?
So the major question is, we didn't know where we were catching the turtles. Were we catching them on a seafloor or up in the water column? So we had to start a research program using satellite tags and ROVs to learn about the behavior of the turtles. It's very important to learn about the behavior of the animal that you're trying not to catch or to catch. Once we had an understanding that we were probably catching them up in the water column, we put a chain mesh across the face, the opening of the dredge, that would prevent turtles from entering the dredge. However, there was still some concern we might be running over them on the seafloor. We didn't have any facts that said that was the case, but we designed a dredge frame that if it encountered a turtle, the turtle would go over the dredge. And we tested that with turtle carcasses that had been washed up on the beaches down in Florida. We put them in front of these new design dredges, and they all went over the dredge. None were run over, and in inspecting the shells for damage, there was virtually no damage. So we were able to verify that this dredge design would work if, in fact, it encountered turtles on the seafloor. And as I've said, in the last decade, we haven't brought up any turtles, dead or alive.
I imagine fishermen, in addition to, of course, wanting to reduce that impact to turtles, are going to have a question anytime you change their gear. Well, does this still work? Am I still going to catch scallops in this case?
And that's an extremely important point. When you go to reduce bycatch, you want to maintain or improve the efficiency of the gear so that you don't increase the amount of hours that the gear needs to be towed. In many of the changes that we've made to the scallop dredge to improve its catch efficiency and to reduce bycatch, 15 years ago, we needed 16,000 square miles of swept area to catch a catch of 20 to 30 million pounds, 20 to 30 million pounds. Today, we make that double that catch in only 3,000 square miles of swept area. So we decreased the footprint of the fishery by 75% and doubled the catch.
That's really, really impressive and really an important, as you said, environmental benefit as well, that's so much less habitat that's actually being physically disturbed by this fishery.
That's correct. In any particular year, the scallop fishery impacts less than 3% of the fishing grounds on a continental shelf between North Carolina and Canada.
And then that also has a benefit to the fishermen, because one of the major costs facing all fishermen at this point is just the cost of fuel to go out there and drive around. If you're driving less, that's got to cost less for the fishermen.
75% reduction in your carbon footprint burning fossil fuels.
Steve Ayres, this issue of fuel efficiency and reducing fuel use is something you've really looked at with ground fishermen and net trawls for fish. How do you try to reduce fuel usage in that fishery?
Well, I think you need to look at the fishing operation as a whole, and the two key areas where fuel is consumed is steaming between port to the fishing ground and back, and between fishing grounds, and then during the fishing operation. During the fishing operation, if you're towing a net through the water, the net generates drag as the gear is towed through the water. That relates to fuel consumption. And so one of the things we can do is look at increasing mesh size in the main part of the trawl net, so that you're basically reducing the resistance of the trawl as it moves through the water. You can use more efficient trawl doors, and these are steel devices that are used at the front end of the trawl to spread the trawl open horizontally and keep it down on the seabed. And by using more hydrodynamically designed trawl doors, you can generate the same opening force but at the same time produce less drag. So more efficient trawl doors, larger mesh openings are two key areas where you can reduce fuel consumption. Putting a fuel flow meter on a fishing boat is a great step forward as well, because many fishermen, particularly with the older boats, don't have a fuel flow meter. And when you put one of them on, fishermen instantly, it's like their eyes are like moths to a flame. They're always watching the fuel flow meter, and they're reducing the throttle and playing with the throttle. So when steaming between grounds or to and from the fishing port, they're often adjusting the throttle so that they're burning less fuel. And we find that that's a great tool as well. In fact, that's perhaps low-hanging fruit when it comes to introducing fuel-saving measures, is to introduce a fuel flow meter, because every fisherman that I know where we've put one on has said, this is great, I really love it, I like what I'm doing. And they really do change their fishing behaviour as a result, because they can see instantaneously how much more or less fuel they're going to burn.
That's Steve Ayres of the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Also with me, Ron Smolowitz of Coonamesset Farm and Tim Werner of the New England Aquarium. I'm Heather Goldstone. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking today about efforts to design fishing gear, includes hooks, nets, traps, that catch only what fishermen are allowed to catch and can sell, nothing else. My guests have been working to design that kind of gear. They're Steve Ayres, a research scientist at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, Tim Werner, a senior scientist with the New England Aquarium, and Ron Smolowitz of the Coonamesset Farm Foundation. Now, Steve Ayres, before the break, you were talking about ways to, in some cases, redesign trawl nets so that you use less fuel. But here's the real question. When you put a net in the water and you're trying to catch one species of fish, say you're trying to catch cod and nothing else, is it possible to design a net that does that? Because it really seems like when you put a net in the water, there's only so much control you can have over what it catches.
Yeah, and that's a fair statement. I mean, the reality is that because the species are often mixed or inhabiting the same area over the seabed, that it's very difficult to particularly with trawl gear, to select one species out, retain that species, and not retain other species as well. So it's a really challenging thing to do. And there are fishing gears out there that are more selective, but the problem with those, some of those at least, is that you don't catch as much volume as you might need, and or they may use, you know, when you look at the amount of fuel that they use, or the value of the catch, the volume of the catch, is just not economically viable to use. So what trawling does, at least, is it allows a large volume of fish to be caught in a relatively short period of time. And unfortunately, the collateral with that is that there is some bycatch that's caught. Now, in the ground fishing industry here, depending on the gear that's used and where it's being fished, trawling can actually be quite selective. And some of the work we've done just monitoring catches with fishermen, and 80% or 90% of their catch is all landed, and the bycatch is relatively minor. So there are areas and times of the year when fishing, or ground fishing anyway, can be very selective. And again, partly that's due to the large meshes that are used. A lot of fishermen have moved towards square mesh material, which means that the meshes in the bag that retains the catch is open all the time. That allows a lot of small fish to escape, and some fishermen have actually moved up to 7-inch material as well. So that's a pretty large opening to allow fish to escape.
And I understand that sometimes just changing even, you've said here square versus diamond shape, just kind of changing the orientation of the net can change what actually is retained by the net and what's able to flow through. I mean, it seems like some pretty subtle changes can make a big difference.
That's correct. And so this area of the net I'm talking about is the bag at the end that retains all the fish. And with diamond mesh netting, the problem with that is that as the catch loads up in the cod end, those diamond meshes close. The width of the diamond mesh becomes narrower. And so the opportunity for round fish to escape is vastly compromised. Whereas if you turn that material sideways so it becomes a square mesh, the volume of the catch doesn't matter because that square mesh always retains its square shape, which means that the fish always have an opportunity, providing it's small enough to pass through that mesh.
Tim Werner, I want to shift gears here a little bit. I mean, we've been talking mostly about nets and trawls, but of course this isn't just a net or trawl issue. But you've done some work with nets that are static in the water, gill nets, and trying to keep these from, again, catching things that might be swimming by that aren't really the target of the nets. Talk about that issue a little bit.
Sure. And it's worth pointing out, by the way, that gill nets are a relatively low-budget form of fishing, and most of the world's fishers are in developing countries. Perhaps 98-99% of the world's fishers are small-scale, non-industrial. So while an individual fisher may not have a huge impact on bycatch, when you add up the cumulative impact on non-target species, it's really tremendous. And that impact is not fully accounted for in some of these official reporting figures on bycatch that we hear about and are often cited. Gill nets are, of course, these entangling nets. They can be deployed at the bottom of the ocean or along the surface. The New England Aquarium first cut its teeth in this business, trying to reduce harbor porpoise bycatch with gill nets. And through a series of experiments in the 1990s, it was found that putting a low sound-emitting device called an acoustic pinger, it puts out a signal of about 10 kilohertz. The amount of bycatch that occurred in gill nets was reduced by an order of magnitude. And that led the U.S. government to actually regulate the use of these acoustic pingers in the Gulf of Maine gill net, actually East Coast gill net fisheries. And from there, that technology has gone to the Pacific. It's gone to the California swordfish drift net fishery. It's used in parts of Europe and parts of the Pacific. It doesn't work with all species, but it does work with some. And it's an example of the kinds of technologies you can incorporate into gill nets to reduce some marine mammal bycatch.
That's Tim Werner of the New England Aquarium. Also with me this morning, Steve Ayers of the Gulf of Maine Research Institute and Ron Smallowitz of Coonamesset Farm. You're listening to Living Lab. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Tim, you're talking about putting these sound-emitting pingers on nets to try to keep dolphins and perhaps some other species away from the nets. I wonder, though, with all of the concern about noise in the ocean and the impact that that's having on dolphins and whales, is there any concern that these pingers might actually be causing some harm?
In some cases, it's certainly a concern. In fact, in parts of Europe, pingers are actually used to exclude harbor porpoise from an entire bay. So if the level of deployment of these devices is carried out to a large extent, that you can get what we call habitat exclusion, in which animals are deprived they'll avoid their typical habitat. In the other concern that sometimes is raised involves habituation. If you keep hearing a sound constantly, maybe after a while you're like, "Oh, I know what that is. That's no problem. I'm gonna go in there." And I should point out, though, in the case of New England, in the gillnet fisheries, neither of those issues appears to be a concern, despite many, many years of monitoring the fishery. While it's certainly an issue that needs to be tracked and monitored, in many cases, the benefits far outweigh, as far as we know, what the potential consequences might be.
Now, another area where you've been working again to protect marine mammals from fishing gear is actually with long lining, and you're changing the hooks that are used? How do you change hooks to make it safer for dolphins or whales?
Well, I'm not changing the hooks, but we did support some research with fishermen and with scientists looking at different types of hooks and the impact that they might have on non-target species. Our main focus has been on the pelagic Atlantic pelagic longline fishery that largely targets yellowfin tuna, swordfish, and swordfish. There's the level of bycatch of short fin pilot whales was a concern to regulators. So working within what's called the Atlantic Longline Take Reduction Team, this is a group of scientists, nonprofit groups, fishermen, government regulators that come together to collectively look at how to solve particular problems related to marine mammal bycatch. One idea that emerged was looking at a hook that might be more bendable to a pilot whale, which on average weighs some 227 kilograms, sometimes reaching a maximum of 1,300 kilograms, but would be still strong enough to retain a yellowfin tuna, which and the size of the yellowfin tuna caught in this fishery rarely exceeds 90 kilograms. So there's a sweet spot in the middle there where perhaps you can reduce the bending strength of hook so that a pilot whale can release itself from the line, whereas the fisherman doesn't lose the yellowfin tuna. And this idea has gotten some traction within the take reduction team and the National Marine Fisheries Service, with the agreement and support of fishermen, is now drafting regulations to change the types of hooks that will be used in that fishery.
Okay, so one more example of trying to protect marine mammals from fishing gear, and this one hits really quite close to home, and it's, as you mentioned earlier, trying to reduce the entanglement of large whales, in particular in lobster gear, in the lines that connect a string of lobster pots. And we've seen some changes, some mandated changes in the types of rope, and kind of similar to the hooks you're talking about, making sure that ropes might break if a large whale was pulling on them instead of the kind of pulling that might happen when a fisherman's trying to retrieve the pots. But there's actually been work in recent years to try to eliminate those ropes altogether. How do you make a lobster pot or a string of lobster pots that doesn't involve rope?
It does involve rope, but what you do is you take the rope out of the water column. What you're referring to is what we call ropeless fishing, and it's actually a form of fishing that's used in a lobster fishery in southeastern Australia. And the idea is you take the ropes in lobster pots. What you usually have is a buoy at the surface and a rope that extends down to your pot. And that serves two functions. One is it gives you a rope so that you can haul up your gear and your catch. But the other thing it does is it tells everybody else that, hey, there's some gear here in the water, so that you can retrieve it again and that hopefully other people won't run into it. Now, the idea here is that rather than have the rope extending from the seafloor up to the surface, You take the rope and you put it down at depth. So you, for example, keep it in some sort of canister, or perhaps you put it on a spool that is at the bottom of the seafloor. And then when you're ready to haul the gear, it either comes up by a timed release or perhaps through an acoustic release. So similar to the way you open your car in a parking lot, you just click a button and the door opens. In this case, that signal releases a mechanical device that unhooks the rope and the buoy system, and it comes up to the surface, and then you haul your gear.
That takes care of the how you get it back, but how do you then take care of the problem of people knowing, other fishermen or the same fishermen knowing where those traps are on the seafloor when they're completely out of sight?
Well, that's a challenge, and we're still working on that. The same signal that you have from the transponder down at the seafloor that sends the signal up to the boat could also be used to let other people know that there's gear there. So another fisherman might not be able to release that gear, just in the same way you can't open somebody else's car in the parking lot, but because you have a unique signal. But they might actually receive some sort of signal that the gear is down there. Another way to do this is through passive acoustic detection. And that is, with existing technologies that fishing and other boats have in their wheelhouse, they can actually detect, using fish finders or bottom sounding devices, the presence of something that's not a fish, or that's not typically seafloor, that you can tell it carries an acoustic signal of what a fishing, what we call a fishing trawl, might look like, a lobster trawl.
Now, Tim Werner, I have to tell you, I've talked with some lobstermen from Cape Cod about this idea in recent years, and responses have typically ranged from skeptical to downright dismissive of this idea. How feasible is it, and how much buy-in are you getting from industry?
Yeah, I've had those conversations too, many times. It depends. What happens is that fishermen are concerned that regulators come in and enact regulatory changes that threaten them, that threaten their industry, and so that gives them an incentive to want to look at different sort of new technologies that might be used to fish. Now, the ropeless fishing idea is a bit of a long shot because of all these issues that we've talked about, not to mention the high cost. But over time, as the research continues, when you might achieve economies of scale under larger production scenarios, and if you're a fisherman and you face the potential of getting your fishing grounds closed out completely, that gives you an incentive to start to think about looking at potentially other alternatives. So it's worth doing the research collaboratively between scientists and fishermen to look at the prospect of some of these things. And some pan out and some don't. But unless you do the research, you never figure out which ones are the most promising.
That's Tim Werner of the New England Aquarium. Also with us, Steve Ayers of the Gulf of Maine Research Institute and Ron Smolowitz of Coonamesset Farm. We will talk more about how to get fishermen involved in the research and development of new fishing gear when Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking this hour about efforts to reduce bycatch and other negative environmental impacts of commercial fishing. With me is Steve Ayers of the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, Ron Smolowitz of Coonamesset Farm, and Tim Werner of the New England Aquarium, all of whom have been working to develop new types of fishing gear and new instruments that can help fishermen reduce bycatch and environmental impacts. And one of the things we were talking about just before the break is the importance of getting fishermen involved in this kind of work. Ron Smolowitz, you work very closely with the Southern New England scallop industry. Much of your research is funded in a kind of a unique way by the industry. Talk about how you work with fishermen and how important that relationship is to you.
Okay, Heather. It's very important to have the fishermen take the lead in researching any particular problem. They usually are the ones that know the problem to the greatest extent, and the ones that have the ideas on how to solve the problem. And what we did in the scallop fishery, and the scallop fishery ranges from Maine through North Carolina, there's 340 large vessels that are permitted in the sea scallop fishery. We set aside a portion of our allocated catch, 1.25 million pounds, which is worth about $15 million today, to fund research. And we... the government manages the program and solicits proposals after the industry and the managers set the priorities. And the proposals are reviewed for technical merit, and also by a management committee that contains fishermen and managers. So the fishermen are involved in the setting of the priorities and the choosing of the proposals. And then when the research is usually performed, for the most part, on commercial scallop vessels with commercial scallopers working side by side with the researchers. And that's a fully integrated industry, academic, government process.
I think the stereotype that's out there is that fishermen in general are quite resistant to regulation or oversight and changes to how they do things. Has that been your experience with the scallop industry?
When the fishermen are involved from the very beginning, they are not resistant to the regulations. Actually, it ensures that the proper set of regulations end up being developed and put into place and are enforceable, because the fishermen are the ones that really know whether something's going to work or not work. And in a, you know, it's when you buy a piece of equipment, it has an operating manual. And in, when we fish, we have the fishing gear, but we also have the management regime, which is the operating manual. And you have to make sure that you have the appropriate operations to match your gear. And the fishermen are the ones that, in the scallop fishery, pretty much design the management system and decide on the appropriate gear.
It sounds like you've got a pretty good system working with the scallop industry to make some proactive and really positive changes. How unusual do you think that is?
It's very unusual. I think we have, for the size of the fishery, it's the largest wild capture scallop fishery in the world. And for this, the number of participants, the way it works together with an advisory panel, and the fact that it sets aside money for the research, it also pays for its own observers. It sets aside a portion to catch to compensate vessels for observers. It's very unique, and it's around the world, people look at this fishery as a shining example of the way management should go.
Steve Ayres, you also work with fishermen extensively, but the Gulf of Maine Research Institute takes kind of a different approach or a different tactic for funding and creating those collaborations. So how do you structure things?
Well, in terms of funding, we compete like other organizations for limited funds, whether it's from NOAA or elsewhere. But we certainly do have a long history of partnership with the fishing industry. I don't think I've ever submitted a proposal in my time here in New England that hasn't had fishing industry involvement. And we don't do work on research boats. We work on boats that belong to fishermen. So certainly in my area, at least, we're always working with the fishing industry. And in fact, the projects I'm working on at the moment, I have a team of eight individuals working collaboratively together. Four of them are fishermen and one of them is a net maker, and there's two scientists. So we like Ron, work very closely with the fishing industry to try to develop new gear, work with them, identify their ideas. The project I just spoke of, where we've got a large team of fishermen, we had an idea for changing a gear design, and we went to fishermen and said, what do you think? And we subsequently collected their ideas. We've been testing their ideas as model nets in a flume tank in St. John's, Newfoundland. And in a couple of weeks' time, we'll be going to sea to test one of those gears. So, again, we work closely with the fishing industry and are often soliciting their ideas for new gear designs.
Tim Werner, you work on fisheries throughout the globe, not just here in New England. Do you think there are those same opportunities to work closely and collaboratively with fishermen in some of these developing nations where there are really important bycatch issues?
Absolutely. In the same way that we work very closely with longline and lobster pot fishermen and other fishermen here in the U.S., we have long-term collaborative relationships, for example, in Brazil and Argentina. I think one of the most intensive field studies looking at bycatch deterrence for marine mammals and gillnets is probably our field site in northern Argentina, where we've been working very closely with fishermen and local scientists and the government to evaluate a number of potential bycatch deterrents. And these are looking at trying to reduce the bycatch of an endangered species called the Franciscana dolphin. There's only about between 30 and 50,000 remaining. It only occurs from southern Brazil, mid-coast Brazil, south to mid-coast Argentina. And it's a coastal species, and the rates of bycatch are very unsustainable.
Now, we've mentioned a few different times the cost. I mean, there's the cost of the research and the testing of new types of gear, then just the cost of having to buy new gear. How do fishermen absorb that cost, and does it end up being passed on to consumers when there have to be these major kinds of gear changes? Ron Smolowitz, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, it varies by fishery and how close to the margin the particular fisherman is working and what the impact's going to be. So scallop fishery, large offshore vessels are very profitable. And if they have to make a gear change to be able to optimize their fishing, it's really not a big cost to them. However, a small coastal boat that might have to buy some expensive electronics or be limited by season or operating area could be an extremely costly event.
And in your experience, when you've got new gear innovations, to get those adopted, does that kind of happen organically, that fishermen say, oh, well, here's a better piece of gear that's going to optimize our fishery, we'll adopt that? Or does there have to be a mandate, a management, enforceable rule that says you have to take on this new kind of gear?
Well, I've been doing this for quite a while. So I've learned through my mistakes that you don't go and put a piece of fishing gear out there and present it to the fishermen and say, hey, we're going to do this, we're going to try this, or worst case, oh, this is going to be regulated. Well, what we do now is if we have an idea, for example, a change in gear, and one of the things we're working on now in a scallop fishery is extending the linkage in the bag to allow small scallops to escape. Thank God we have a huge incoming year class of small scallops, so many that they even get caught in the current 4-inch large rings. So we come up with an idea. We run it by what we call the early innovators, guys in the industry that are well-respected amongst their peers, and say, hey, you know, we'll give you one of these things. You go out and try it, and we'll stick a guy on board to take data. And they say, sure. And they go out, and they come back and say, this is garbage, and then we stop that. Or they say, hey, you know, this is great. We can modify it and do that. Or they say, Ron, I'd like to keep that for a couple of more trips if you don't mind.
And then you know you've really got a winner, right?
And that's what we have now is an idea that's already been tested throughout the fleets. We make boats out of Virginia, New Jersey, Massachusetts have tried it. The words on the dock, hey, this thing really works. Boats are gearing up on their own. And then, you know, the research sort of follows. So you have to do the research to get the scientific statistical proof that it works, and then it goes into the management process. In the meantime, the boats are already switching over and trying it. The same thing happened with turtle chains. The boats were using them voluntarily 2 years before the regulatory system responded and put it into place as a management measure.
And Steve Ayers, has that been your experience with the ground fishing industry in Maine? Does it have to be mandated or regulated to get new gear into the fishery?
Well, there has been a history of mandating new gear in the fishery, but there's also been a quite good history of voluntary change occurring as well. And although that's a little bit more of a problem these days because the fishery is not as prosperous as it once was. And so, you know, when a fisherman doesn't know if he's going to be in the fishery in 12 months' time, it's unlikely that he's going to invest in new gear, even if it might save him fuel or be more selective so he catches more of what he wants and less of what he doesn't want, because you're asking him to invest in gear and when he may not be in the fishery in 12 months. So that's been more of a challenge. And So some of the things we've done is tried to make fishing gear available for them to test free of charge. For example, the hydrodynamic trawl doors that I spoke of earlier, we have some or had some at some net makers down in Rhode Island and in New Bedford, and fishermen were able to test this gear free of charge. They just had to pick the gear up. They could go to sea and test it and see whether they enjoyed the doors, whether they made them work. And I should point out that these doors, based on our research at least, fishermen save around 10 to 12% of their fuel. And they can pay off the doors, should they purchase them, in around 12 months or a little bit longer. But again, if you are not guaranteed a future in the fishery, it's pretty hard to get a guy to invest. And so, you know, we have some slightly different challenges, and you know, we just have to do the best we can and make gear available and in some cases provide some rebates. That's been reasonably successful. But once again, the big problem comes down to the fact that if you're not guaranteed to stay in the fishery, you're not likely to invest heavily in new gear.
Real catch-22 there. Tim Warner, is there a way for consumers to know whether the seafood they are buying is causing a lot of bycatch, or is one of the fisheries that's working proactively to reduce bycatch? Is there really any way to know that on the consumer end?
It's certainly getting better than it was a decade ago. A number of restaurants and retailers are trying to highlight where their seafood comes from, and so that you have a good idea of whether or not it was caught using sustainable means. But that largely is a luxury, I think, at this stage in the developed world. And again, as I pointed out earlier, most of the world lacks that capacity, political will, resources for monitoring and enforcement to do the kinds of things that we're doing here in the U.S. and in other developed countries. And there we have to look at a number of other incentives for fishers to actually modify their practices to reduce bycatch.
What kinds of other methods?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. There's, for example, there are low-cost methods of if you can't fix a particular year, one option is to say, well, why don't we just change the kind of gear we're using in this particular fishery? And then you can run a series of collaborative experiments with fishermen, and they can figure out if they can make as much money or over the same amount of period of time that they would normally fish using other gear, or perhaps get a better value for the product in the marketplace because it's a better quality being caught with a gear that does less damage to the target species.
Plenty of challenges. Also sounds like a lot of progress in this area. Tim Warner is a senior scientist at the New England Aquarium. Steve Ayers is a research scientist at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. And Ron Smolowitz is with the Coonamesset Farm Foundation, all working to design fishing gear that has fewer negative environmental impacts. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Heather.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.